the Fairy Swordfish, an aircraft which was outdated even before its first combat mission, was, ironically, one of the most iconic aircraft to be operated by the British during the Second World War. Initially designed as a torpedo bomber for the fleet air arm of the Royal Navy, the Swordfish, which affectionately became nicknamed the String Bag in the later years of the war, was a product of the mid-interwar period, conceived when biplanes still held some level of relevance. Yet, by the time it entered service in 1936, it was already fast becoming obsolete. The aircraft's basic design, characterized by its open cockpit, fabric-covered fuselage, and fixed landing gear, was a sharp contrast to the all-metal monoplanes that were entering service at the same time, and its maximum top speed of just over 140 miles per hour was slow, even by the standards of the early 1930s. But despite these apparent limitations, the Swordfish would go on to prove itself in the most demanding of conditions. Its service during World War II was marked by a series of audacious and highly successful operations that demonstrated its effectiveness as a torpedo bomber. And by war's end, it had sunk more enemy shipping than any other Allied aircraft. The Swordfish also proved its versatility in a variety of other roles as well, from anti-submarine warfare in the Atlantic to mine laying, naval reconnaissance, and numerous convoy escort missions. Beloved by its pilots for its viceless handling, the Swordfish earned itself an excellent reputation with the fleet's air arm. While other aircraft of its era were being rapidly rendered obsolete at the same time by technological advances, and were replaced, the Swordfish would continue to serve throughout the war, outlasting even its intended replacement, the Fairy Albacore. This longevity can be attributed to several factors, including its simplicity, ease of maintenance, and, importantly, its suitability for operations from small escort carriers, where its low landing speed and excellent handling characteristics made it ideal for the limited deck space. And also, more importantly still, these missions kept it far, far, far away from enemy fighter aircraft, who would otherwise have wiped the floor with it. The Fairy Swordfish was a testament to the idea that effectiveness in war is not always determined by cutting-edge technology. Its success was due not to speed or overwhelming firepower, but instead due to its reliability, adaptability, the skill of its aircrews, and a healthy dose of luck. It was basically an underdog, part of a class of interwar designs that had no right to be as successful as it was, which is why I have something of a huge soft spot for it, and it's why we are looking at its history in today's video. But hang on a minute, Rex, didn't you already do a video on the Fairy Swordfish? Well, yes, I did, several years ago, but that was only a short 17-minute overview video, and if I'm being honest, it did not do the Swordfish the justice it deserves. So, today, I'm giving you a documentary-length, glorified lecture on the development and history of the Fairy Swordfish, and if I've done my math right, you'll be stuck with me for about the next hour, so I hope you brought snacks. Now, speaking of documentary-length content, today's video has been very kindly sponsored by Magellan TV. Now, for those unaware, Magellan TV hosts a wide variety of curated documentaries, covering a huge range of topics. It's completely ad-free, and includes a growing collection of new 4K content which is added every week. It may come as a surprise to some of you that I'm a bit of a fan of aviation-themed documentaries, shocking I know, and one that I thought a lot of you would be interested in was this documentary series called That's Our Brother Saving a D-Day Legend. This is a three-episode series that covers the history and restoration of a Douglas C-47 named That's Our Brother. This was the very aircraft that led over 800 other C-47s that dropped over 13,000 paratroopers over the French coast at the commencement of D-Day. The series details the history of the aircraft, its rediscovery in a scrapyard, and eventual acquisition by the Commemorative Air Force, and their Herculean efforts to restore the plane and get it flying for the 75th anniversary of D-Day itself. So if you want to check out this series, or other documentaries that Magellan has on offer, as there are a lot, click on the link in the description below, or scan the QR code that's been floating around on the screen here, to get a 30 free days trial to watch That's All Brother Saving a D-Day Legend, and all the rest of Magellan TV's extensive collection of over 3,000 documentaries. So once again, thank you very much to Magellan TV for sponsoring today's video. And now, let's take a closer look at the fairy swordfish. The origins of the swordfish, or rather, the events and decisions that led to its development, can be traced back to the time period of about 1928 to 1930. Now, in 1930, Marcel Lebelle, Fairey's chief designer, began working on two related aircraft designs. The first was the Fairey S9/30, which was a spotting and reconnaissance aircraft for the Royal Navy, which had been drawn up to a specification of the same title. The second aircraft became known as the Fairey TSR, which stood for Torpedo Spotting Reconnaissance. But at the time, it was simply known as the Greek Machine, because it was being built in response to interest from the Greek Navy. Whereas the S9/30 was an official design being built for the British Admiralty, the TSR was developed as a private venture. This was not only because it was being developed for an overseas customer, but also because Fairey had thus far had poor success when it came to the development of torpedo bombers. And to give full context for this, we need to go back a few years before 1930. Now, by 1930, the fleet air arm had most of its aircraft supplied to it by just two manufacturers, Blackburn Aircraft and Fairey Aviation. The latter had supplied fighters, bombers, and reconnaissance aircraft to the fleet air arm since the end of the First World War, but Blackburn had developed something of a monopoly when it came to the production of torpedo bombers. Indeed, they had enjoyed great success with the Blackburn Dart, which proved that even an aircraft that looked vaguely like a snub-nosed and overweight pigeon could still be an effective weapon delivery platform, and then the Blackburn Ripon, which, in a departure for Blackburn, actually looked quite good. Now, even though Fairey had technically built more aircraft for the Navy during the 1920s, Blackburn was the company that held the real prestige. The torpedo was the primary weapon for the fleet air arm, crucial for damaging, disabling, or ideally sinking enemy ships, and thus the torpedo bomber was the most important aircraft in the fleet's inventory. As an aside, this was also because the use of high explosive bombs had not been as enthusiastically followed by the Royal Navy when compared to their American counterparts, though that situation would eventually change in the latter part of the 1930s, at least to some degree. But getting back to torpedo bombers, in the eyes of many, the other aircraft types operated by the fleet, fighters, reconnaissance planes, spotting aircraft, were essentially there either to support the torpedo planes or the fleet's larger capital ships. In March of 1928, the Air Ministry and Admiralty issued a new specification to the aircraft industry for a torpedo bomber. Although the Blackburn Ripon Mark II had only just been ordered, it was seen only as a temporary solution. The Ripon was originally designed to meet a requirement from way back in 1923, but with the arrival of new aero engines and the 18-inch Mark 10 torpedo, a more advanced aircraft design was required. Blackburn, Fairey, and Hanley Page would each submit a design proposal. However, the specification was cancelled before any serious considerations could be made. This was mostly due to production of the Mark 10 torpedo being cancelled, as the Royal Navy wanted to move on to larger and heavier weapons. A new specification was then drawn up around said larger, heavier weapon, but this too was then cancelled as the Air Ministry disagreed with the Navy, a not uncommon event during the interwar years, on their use of larger torpedoes when it came to attack aircraft. The Air Ministry insisted that a smaller torpedo was more suitable, as it would require a lighter aircraft and thus a smaller aircraft, which meant more aircraft per aircraft carrier, and ignoring the protestations of several naval officers, as prototypes had already been ordered for the previous specification, a new specification was then drawn up in 1930, and this was known as M1/30. Fairey had not submitted any further design proposals beyond the original submission to the 1928 specification. This was partly due to a lack of enthusiasm, as Blackburn's design already appeared to be a fan favourite with naval officials, thus further cementing the company's torpedo bomber monopoly, and partly because Fairey held a near equal monopoly when it came to the production of spotting and reconnaissance aircraft. At around the same time that the Air Ministry imposed changes on the torpedo bomber requirements, the Admiralty had issued specification S9/30, which called for a new fleet spotting and reconnaissance plane to replace the popular but old Fairey 3, which had been in service in one form or another since 1918. And this is where we come to the Fairey S930. Now, as mentioned before, this aircraft was designed by Fairey's chief designer Marcel Lebel, and it was technically the progenitor of the Swordfish, in that its design was used as the basis of the TSR, which was designed only a couple of months later. The S930 represented a significant departure from previous aircraft produced by Fairey for the fleet air arm. The aircraft featured a more modern design with a single bay, staggered wing configuration, which was a contrast to the long, unswept and unstaggered two-bay wings of the Fairey 3 series. It featured a steel structure covered in fabric as opposed to wood. It came equipped with two machine guns, and it was eventually powered by a steam-cooled Rolls-Royce Kestrel V12, which produced 525 horsepower. But how does a lightly armed reconnaissance plane evolve into the plucky, venerable Swordfish that we all know and love today? Well, two things happened. Firstly, Fairey got wind of the fact that the Greek Navy was looking at replacing their existing inventory of Fairey 3Fs. They wanted a multi-purpose aircraft that could be capable of both torpedo attacks as well as reconnaissance missions. In response to this, Marcel Lebel began work on a private venture based on the lines of the S9/30 reconnaissance plane, and this was informally known as the Greek Machine. Secondly, Charles Richard Fairey, the company founder, and Marcel Lebel had been approached by several officers of the Royal Navy about a similar concept, a fleet aircraft that combined the roles of torpedo attack, reconnaissance, and perhaps some light bombing as well. Thus far, the fleet air arm itself was against such a concept, believing that having more specialised types of aircraft would yield better results. But many individuals felt that the worsening economic climate, courtesy of the Great Depression, would soon force the fleet air arm to combine some of its aircraft roles owing to reductions in its budget. As it turned out, these predictions became a reality far sooner than expected, as by the end of 1930, the Air Ministry was already putting a lot of pressure on the Navy to reduce the number of aircraft types it operated. This began a worrying trend that saw the fleet air arm being forced to compromise on aircraft requirements at almost every level, while, in comparison, the Royal Air Force was given significantly more freedom, and this would lead to the development of two especially compromised aircraft, the Blackburn Skua and the Fairey Fulmar. Neither earned themselves a particularly sterling record, and both contributed to the poor, albeit unfairly given, reputation of the fleet air arm in the late interwar, early World War II period. But from this chaotic time of bungled specifications, Air Ministry meddling, and a general neglect of the true requirements of British naval aviation, there was one unlikely success story. Upon learning that the fleet air arm would be needing aircraft that combined multiple roles, Richard Fairey spoke with the Admiralty about the private venture that Lebel was developing for the Greek Navy. The Admiralty was immediately interested, as they were literally in the process of developing a new specification that combined the roles of torpedo bombing and reconnaissance, and work on the prototype Greek machine was accelerated, so that even though construction had begun after the Fairey S930 reconnaissance plane, it would be completed almost a year beforehand. As it was designed for the Greek Navy first, the prototype was powered by their preferred engine, the 625-horsepower Armstrong Siddeley Panther 6. This was a 14-cylinder twin-row radial that drove a Watts two-blade wooden propeller. This powered the aircraft, serial number F1875, on its first flight on the 21st of March 1933, with Fairey's chief test pilot Chris Staniland at the controls. Now, by this point, Greek interest in the prototype had actually more or less completely faded, and following the initial test flights, when it appeared that the Royal Navy would be the only serious customer moving forward, LaBelle agreed to a Navy request to re-engine the prototype. In July of 1933, it was re-equipped with a 635-horsepower Bristol Pegasus, a 9-cylinder radial, and it received the official designation of Fairey Torpedo Spotting Reconnaissance Aircraft, better known as the Fairey TSR. This was not the only aircraft to receive the TSR designation, though. Fairey had competition. Gloster Aircraft were working on their Model 38 TSR, and far more worrying for Fairey was the offering from Blackburn. The reigning torpedo bomber champion had produced a formidable competitor in the Blackburn TSR, which made use of a 700-horsepower Armstrong Siddeley Tiger engine. Faced with such competition, Fairey really couldn't afford any mistakes if it was to finally secure a contract to produce a torpedo bomber for the Royal Navy. Which meant that, naturally, after many flawless test flights where nothing went wrong, in which the Fairey TSR showed excellent handling qualities, it then decided to try and kill Fairey's chief test pilot and destroy itself in the process. Because why not? It all went wrong on September the 11th, 1933. Chris Staniland took the TSR up for a test flight to assess its spin performance with a leading-edge slat system. The TSR was extremely stable, and it proved particularly difficult to actually induce it into a spin. This was not unusual in aircraft of this configuration, and the competing Blackburn design was also very difficult to put into a spin. But unfortunately, when Staniland finally managed to encourage the TSR to enter a spin, it was then impossible to recover from it. Quickly, and without warning, the attitude of the spin became very flat, with the nose almost on the horizon, the controls became ineffective, and any attempt to regain control via opening the throttle merely caused the aircraft to shake about as violently as it was now spinning. Plummeting in a sickening series of spins from 14,000 feet, Staniland tried everything he could to regain control, but after the 12th rotation, he decided it was time to bail out. It was then that he would become one of the few people in existence to ever have to bail out of the same aircraft twice in the same incident, as, having leapt from the pilot's cockpit, the relative motion and force of the spin threw him back into the rear cockpit of the aircraft, from which he then successfully bailed out. The TSR, of course, was a complete write-off, and for Fairey, this was a disaster. There had only been the one prototype built, and there was no second machine under construction to carry on the testing program. Meanwhile, Blackburn's TSR prototype was nearing completion, and Gloster's Model 38 had already been flying for about 2 months. Marcel LaBelle and the rest of his team at Fairey were faced with a serious challenge. They not only had to modify the design of the Fairey TSR to address the spinning problem, but they also had to produce a new prototype in record time. Despite the enormity of the challenge, LaBelle and his team would redesign, rebuild, and have the TSR flying again in just 7 months. The project was given top priority by Richard Fairey, and normal working procedures were thrown completely out the window. As soon as design drawings for a certain part or section of the aircraft were complete, that section was immediately assembled in whatever part of the factory floor was most convenient, other aircraft projects be damned. The result was that the Fairey TSR-2, serial number K4190, flew for the first time on April 17, 1934, with plenty of time to spare for it to attend official Air Ministry evaluations. Though visually similar, the TSR-2 featured a few design changes when compared to its unlucky predecessor, and most of them were made to address the dangerous flat-spinning problem. An extra bay was added to the fuselage structure, anti-spin strakes were installed on the rear fuselage, and the tail was redesigned with a larger vertical stabilizer and rudder. This increased the total length of the aircraft by just under 3 feet, and the shift in the center of gravity because of this necessitated the addition of 4 degrees of sweep back to the upper wing. Aside from some minor tweaks to the internal layout of the aircraft's structure, the construction of the TSR-2 was more or less the same. And to save me repeating myself, I'll leave the details of the airframe aside until we get to the production model of the Swordfish itself a little bit later. After successfully completing manufacturer trials in June, the TSR-2 went to Martlesham Heath for early service trials. It then paid a quick visit to RAE Farnborough for catapult tests, then graced the deck of HMS Courageous for deck handling trials, and was then sent back to Martlesham Heath for a more thorough assessment against its competitors. In comparison to its competitors, the TSR-2 fared better than expected, though admittedly all of the competing designs missed the mark in straight-line performance, as none of them could go beyond 150 miles per hour. The TSR-2 was found to be on par, if not better, than the Blackburn TSR, now known as the Blackburn Shark, which had already received a production order from the Fleet Air Arm, and the Gloucester TSR-38 was outperformed by both the Fairey and Blackburn designs, and did not proceed beyond the prototyping stage. The TSR-2's success in the trials led to the Air Ministry placing an order for 3 more prototypes, essentially pre-production models, and then a production batch of 86 aircraft in the spring of 1935, which was quickly followed by another order for 104 aircraft following early service trials. The type was officially given the name of Swordfish, in keeping with the new tradition of naming torpedo bombers after predatory fish, and the 3 pre-production aircraft would serve as the immediate precursors to the Swordfish Mark I. These 3 aircraft, designated K5660, 661, and 662, were completed between December 35 and January 1936. Now, there aren't a lot of photos of these particular airframes, so whilst I may be talking about them for the next few minutes, the images on the screen may not be of the particular airframe in question, so apologies for that. K5660 was the first of the 3 pre-production Swordfish aircraft that were completed. This one made its maiden flight on the 31st of December 1935. As the first pre-production model, it was primarily used for manufacturer trials, which were conducted at Fairey's Great West Aerodrome. These trials aided in identifying and addressing any remaining issues in the design that could affect the aircraft's performance in service. During the testing phase, particular attention was given to the ailerons, which, while effective at all speeds, had a tendency to snatch during stalls. This was an important issue to resolve, as the Swordfish needed to be reliable and easy to handle under a variety of low-speed operational conditions, particularly during takeoff and landing on aircraft carriers. The tests also included evaluations of lateral and longitudinal stability, with various modifications being trialled to improve overall control. This included the addition of Flettner strips on the ailerons. K5661, the second pre-production aircraft, was completed on the 19th of February 1936. Unlike 660, which was primarily used for manufacturers' trials, 661 was the first of the 3 pre-production aircraft to be delivered to the Fleet Air Arm itself for service trials. Flight Lieutenant Duncan Menzies, who had been heavily involved in the testing of the earlier TSR prototypes, was one of the main pilots involved with conducting these tests. The tests carried out with 661 focused on general handling, stability, and performance. The tests also confirmed that the earlier modifications made, following the prototype spin problems, had successfully resolved these issues. K-5662, the third and final pre-production Swordfish, was completed in March 1936, and was unique among the three as it was fitted with floats. This was essential for evaluating the Swordfish's potential for operations from battleships and cruisers equipped with catapult launch systems. Testing of 662 in its floatplane configuration took place at Southampton Water, where it underwent a series of water-based trials. These tests revealed several challenges associated with operating the Swordfish as a floatplane. The aircraft displayed inadequate maneuverability at slow speeds on the water, and the water rudders failed to meet the turning circle requirements. Additionally, the floats created a significant amount of spray when the aircraft was getting up to speed, which could lead to various unwanted consequences during takeoff, including the complete inundation of the crew. Despite these issues, 662 provided valuable data, and it allowed for the design of the floatplane Swordfish to be modified before entering service. Though it should be said as an aside that the Swordfish as a floatplane was ultimately less popular than its wheeled counterpart. In all, these tests with the three pre-production aircraft confirmed the overall soundness of the Swordfish design, with only a few minor changes being requested, and because of this, full-scale production of the type was allowed to proceed without further delay. Now, with that in mind, we'll pause the historical discussion of the aircraft for a little bit, and we'll briefly take a look at the design of the production Swordfish Mark I, as I believe now would be a good point to do so, and then we'll go on to explore its service history and the other variants that were later developed. Under normal conditions, the Fairey Swordfish was typically operated by a crew of three, consisting of a pilot, an observer, and a telegraphist slash air gunner. The Swordfish Mark I was constructed with a primarily metal airframe, which was built using a combination of steel and duralumin. The forward fuselage and cockpit areas were covered with sheet metal panels, offering additional protection for the crew and critical systems. The rest of the airframe, including the wings and tail surfaces, was covered in doped fabric. The fuselage was built up of four main sections, which facilitated ease of maintenance and repair, which was a crucial feature for an aircraft which would often be deployed far from major repair facilities. The fuselage was also designed to be especially robust, at least compared to land-based equivalents, and this was due to the demanding operational environments that it would encounter, particularly the forces subjected to the airframe, either via carrier operations, and even more so by catapult launching from capital ships. Now, moving on to the aircraft's wings, the upper wing was slightly staggered in relation to the lower, which was a design choice which improved the aircraft's lift and maneuverability. Both the upper and lower wings were constructed using built-up steel strip spars, steel drag struts, and duralumin ribs, which together provided a strong but flexible and lightweight wing structure. Per standard requirements for most carrier aircraft by this time, the Swordfish did feature a wing folding mechanism. The wings could be folded backward along the fuselage, which reduced the aircraft's wingspan from 45 feet 6 inches to just 17 feet 3 inches. The folding process was very straightforward, involving a simple hinge mechanism on the rear spar, and it could be performed by the ground crew aboard the carrier without the need for additional support equipment. When it came to the control surfaces of these wings, the Fairey Swordfish included ailerons on both the upper and lower wings. Another significant feature of the Swordfish wing design was the incorporation of Hanley Page slots in the leading edges of the upper wings. These slots were designed to improve the aircraft's low-speed handling characteristics by allowing airflow to remain attached to the wing surface at higher angles of attack. This innovation helped to reduce the risk of stalling during takeoff and landing, making the Swordfish far more forgiving to fly, especially for rookie pilots. Moving on to the power plant, the Mark I Swordfish was powered by a Bristol Pegasus 3M, which was a 9-cylinder air-cooled radial engine, which produced approximately 690 horsepower for takeoff. The engine was housed in a wide-cored town-end ring, which was designed to smooth the airflow over the engine and thus reduce drag. This cowling also helped to protect the engine from the corrosive effects of salt water, which was, unsurprisingly, a constant hazard for naval-based aircraft. The engine drove a three-blade metal fairy reed propeller, which allowed the Swordfish to achieve a maximum speed of 139 miles per hour at 4,700 feet, whilst carrying a full combat load. Although this was not fast by the standards of the time by any metric, the aircraft's low speed capabilities would actually prove to be useful in a number of scenarios. Not just torpedo attacks, but also mine laying, convoy escort, as it could loiter around enemy ships easily, and anti-submarine warfare. So long as no enemy fighter aircraft in any way, shape or form were within 30 miles of it. Now, speaking of encountering the enemy, the armament and payload capacity of the Swordfish was fairly simple. The aircraft was capable of carrying a single 18-inch, 1,610-pound Mark 12 torpedo slung beneath the fuselage. In place of the torpedo, the Swordfish could also carry a variety of other ordnance, including bombs, depth charges, and mines. In total, it could carry approximately 1,500 pounds of ordnance instead of the torpedo for regular missions. Now, it has been said that some Mark I Swordfish later on, during World War II, carried a little bit more than this at the expense of the telegraphist gunner station being empty to save a little bit of weight, but I've not been able to fully confirm this as it seems that some of these sources seem to be getting mixed up with the Fairey Swordfish Mark I and some of the details of the Fairey Swordfish Mark II, so I don't want to fully commit to that being a thing. So, for the sake of argument with this video, we're going to say that the maximum payload capacity for slung ordnance would be 1,500 pounds. The Swordfish was also equipped with a defensive armament, including a forward-firing Vickers 303 caliber machine gun mounted in the fuselage, and a rear-facing Lewis gun on a flexible mount for the observer. These guns provided the crew with a means of defending the aircraft against enemy fighters, although, as we will discuss later, the performance disparity between the Swordfish and enemy fighters often meant that if there was any air-to-air combat, it was very much one-sided and very brief. Now, speaking of which, and with that cursory look at the technical details of the Swordfish done, if you want to learn more about that, please see the sources I'm going to recommend at the end of this video, let's take a look at the Swordfish's service history. The first unit to receive the Fairey Swordfish Mark I was 825 Naval Air Squadron, stationed aboard the carrier HMS Glorious, which began operations with the Swordfish in July of 1936. 825 NAS, originally a Fairey SEAL squadron, was the oldest squadron in need of re-equipment, making it the logical choice for the introduction of the Swordfish. After receiving their full complement, the squadron re-embarked on HMS Glorious for service in the Mediterranean. The squadron's deployment involved a series of exercises and operations that tested the new aircraft in its roles of torpedo bombing, reconnaissance, and gunnery spotting. The Mediterranean deployment also served as a crucial period for the fleet air arm to refine its tactics and strategies for using the Swordfish, and feedback from the ground and air crews of HMS Glorious would help to standardise the practice for using the aircraft across the fleet. Following 825 Naval Air Squadron, the next units to receive the Swordfish were 811 and 8112, both of which had previously operated the Blackburn Baffin. These squadrons began their transition to the Swordfish in October and December of 1936 respectively. Like 825 NAS, these squadrons were also soon deployed aboard aircraft carriers, and by the end of 1936, the Swordfish had effectively replaced the Blackburn Baffin in the fleet air arm's carrier-based inventory. Now, in comparison to this promising start to the Swordfish's early career, the Blackburn Shark, the Swordfish's main rival, had not been having a particularly good time. Though it had entered service almost 18 months before the Fairey Swordfish, it had been plagued by reliability problems with both its engine and oil systems, and further orders for the type would eventually be cancelled in favour of the Fairey Swordfish instead. Blackburn's monopoly on the torpedo bomber had been officially broken, and indeed, the Shark was the last torpedo bomber that the company would ever produce for the fleet air arm. In addition to these early operational deployments in the Mediterranean and in the English Channel, the Swordfish would also play a prominent role in the Coronation Review of the fleet in 1937, which was held in Spithead and marked the ascension of King George VI to the throne. The event was the last major public display of the pre-war fleet air arm, showcasing the Swordfish alongside numerous other aircraft in the Royal Navy's arsenal. However, by this time, despite the Swordfish being advertised as a frontline torpedo bomber, it already appeared to many within the Navy that the time of the Swordfish would be short-lived, or so they would think. Fairey had already begun development of the Swordfish's successor, the Albacore, in response to specification M7/36. The Albacore was expected to enter service in 1939, partially replacing the Swordfish, though some squadrons would retain it, and then both types would be replaced by a new monoplane torpedo bomber in 1941. This was part of a methodical but gradual peacetime procurement process, where it was usual for a new aircraft specification to be issued just as the current type was entering service. But due to a combination of strategic misjudgments, financial constraints, and production bottlenecks, the Fairey Swordfish would remain in active service long past this 1941 deadline. Oh, and there was also the small baby complication of the Second World War. Speaking of which, at the outbreak of war with Germany in 1939, the Fairey Swordfish was the main torpedo bomber of the fleet air arm. But despite being the fleet's main torpedo bomber, this was not the role that it found itself in during the earliest months of hostilities. With German U-boats running rampant in the Atlantic, the Royal Navy formed anti-submarine hunting groups to patrol the shipping lanes in the western approaches. At the core of these groups was an aircraft carrier, and it was hoped that carrier-borne aircraft would cooperate with destroyers, spotting enemy U-boats and directing the hunting ships to their location, while they also carried out their own air attacks themselves. The aircraft carriers HMS Courageous and HMS Ark Royal played significant roles in these early operations, with Swordfish squadrons conducting extensive patrols over the western approaches. Unfortunately, it was a plan that had several flaws, the biggest of which being that an escorting fleet carrier was very easy to spot at a distance, being somewhat huge, whereas a tiny U-boat was not. The weather in the North Atlantic was also often very poor, with low visibility and rough seas, which complicated both the search for the U-boats and the execution of attacks against them. Additionally, the open cockpit of the Fairey Swordfish exposed the crews to the elements, and this made longer patrols particularly grueling in the northern regions of the Atlantic. Flight crews returning from Arctic anti-submarine patrols usually had to be lifted out from their aircraft by the deck crews of the carriers because they were suffering from various stages of hypothermia, not exactly ideal. Despite these challenges, the Swordfish quickly demonstrated its potential value in the anti-submarine role. On several occasions in the autumn of 1939, Swordfish aircraft successfully located and attacked U-boats, disrupting their operations and forcing them to dive or flee. This was, however, the limit of their success, as no U-boats were directly sunk by Swordfish aircraft in these early operations, and the untested strategy of using fleet carriers for escort operations would soon yield tragic consequences. On the 14th of September 1939, just 2 weeks into the war, HMS Ark Royal, Britain's most capable aircraft carrier, had a brush with U-39 off the northwest coast of Scotland and narrowly avoided being torpedoed, which, on its own, should have been a wake-up call that using such valuable fleet assets to hunt down notoriously elusive and small and dangerous submarines was the epitome of the term F around and find out. Then, just 3 days later, on the 17th of September, the Navy did find out. HMS Courageous was responding to merchant ship distress calls off the coast of Ireland, and four Swordfish aircraft from 811 and 822 Squadron engaged U-53, forcing it into a crash dive. But U-boats seldom travelled alone, and while the Swordfish were busy with U-53, U-29, hitherto undetected, had her periscope trained directly on HMS Courageous. At 19:50 in the evening, she fired three torpedoes. Two of them struck Courageous, and she sank in just 17 minutes. Courageous went down with the loss of 519 hands, including her captain, and among the equipment lost were two full squadrons of Fairey Swordfish. This sent alarm bells ringing through the Admiralty as they looked at the projected numbers for aircraft lost compared to aircraft that were to be built for the next 12 months, and the figure they got at the end was quite concerning. The Swordfish had been ordered into production in the mid-1930s, and by the time war broke out in 1939, it was the most numerous torpedo bomber in the Fleet Air Arms arsenal, but that wasn't saying much. Production rates remained small, and they were not scaled up until early 1939, despite the political warning bells being clearly heard for at least 2 years prior to this. One of the most severe consequences of this was a production gap that occurred in late 1939. According to an assessment made by the Admiralty in August of 39, the expected drop in deliveries of torpedo bombers would leave the Fleet Air Arm dangerously under-equipped just as the war was starting. The last order for Swordfish aircraft was scheduled to be completed in November of 1939, with the Albacore expected to take over in production in December. However, the Albacore's production ramp-up was slower than anticipated, resulting in a sharp decline in the number of aircraft that were going to be delivered to the Fleet Air Arm. In November of 1939, only 26 Swordfish were delivered, and this number fell to just 2 Albacores in December. This was somewhat catastrophic, to put it mildly, as the Admiralty had estimated that the Fleet Air Arm would need at least 50 torpedo bombers per month to keep pace simply with wartime attrition rates. Recognising the severity of the situation, at last, the Admiralty took steps to increase production immediately. One of the key decisions was to keep the Swordfish in production alongside the Albacore, despite the latter being intended as its replacement. The Admiralty also sought to expand production by enlisting other manufacturers, such as Blackburn. Fairey's old rival was initially tasked with a production order for 400 Albacores, but owing to expected production issues, both Blackburn and Fairey pressured the government to change the order to 400 Swordfish instead, and the government agreed. This allowed Fairey to transfer all Swordfish production over to Blackburn, allowing them to focus on the Albacore. However, the first of the Blackburn Swordfish would not be delivered well into 1940, and until then, the Navy had to rely solely on its reserves and pray that it didn't lose too many aircraft. It was with this gloomy prospect lurking in the background that the Swordfish would be thrust into its first major operations, with the beginning of the Norwegian campaign. During the campaign, the Swordfish would score a number of firsts for the Royal Navy. On April the 11th, 1940, Swordfish from HMS Furious were launched in one of their earliest combat missions. Their target was a group of German vessels anchored at Trondheim, including the destroyers Z-17 Dieter von Roeder and Z-21 Wilhelm Heidkamp, and I apologise if I pronounce those wrong. Despite the challenging conditions of poor weather and heavy anti-aircraft fire, the Swordfish managed to score a hit on Z-21, marking the first successful torpedo strike by the fleet air arm during the war. The Swordfish would then go on to earn further success and distinction in an action just before the Second Battle of Narvik. On April the 13th, 1940, a Swordfish float plane, launched from the battleship HMS Warspite, was tasked with locating German ships hidden in the fjords. The aircraft's crew successfully spotted several German destroyers, and then also noticed the submarine U-64, anchored close to the shore. The Swordfish then conducted a low-level attack, dropping two 100-pound anti-submarine bombs on U-64 and sinking it, making it the first U-boat to be sunk by the fleet's air arm during the war. Of course, other operations involving the Swordfish weren't always as successful. Later that same day, a group of 10 Swordfish were deployed from HMS Furious to attack German destroyers with 250-pound high-explosive bombs. Despite heavy anti-aircraft fire, the Swordfish pressed home their attack, but they failed to score any direct hits. During the course of the attack, two Swordfish were shot down, with one crew being rescued after making a forced landing. Following the Second Battle of Narvik, Swordfish aircraft continued to operate in the region, conducting a series of bombing raids, anti-submarine patrols, and reconnaissance missions. These operations were often carried out in extremely challenging conditions, including poor weather, mountainous terrain, and the ever-present threat of enemy fighters. The open cockpit of the Swordfish made these missions particularly unpleasant for the crews, who had to endure freezing temperatures and harsh winds. Now, while some Swordfish crews were being gradually frozen in the skies above Norway, others soon found themselves in action in the slightly more temperate climate of Western Europe. In response to the German invasions of the Netherlands, Belgium, and France, the Swordfish once again found itself performing some roles outside of its original design criteria. Owing to a shortage of support aircraft, the RAF was loaned 5 Swordfish squadrons from the fleet air arm. These were 812, 815, 818, 825, and 829 squadron. Operating from HMS Glorious at first, 825 squadron saw some of the first sorties in the French theatre, tasked with reconnaissance missions over the French coast and parts of northern France. As the situation in France rapidly deteriorated, the squadron shifted to more direct combat roles, and alongside the other Swordfish units, it would conduct daylight bombing raids against German armoured columns, and by night it would lay mines off the French coast or attack port installations. Now, surprisingly, and considering the aged appearance, design, and speed of the Swordfish, during the Battle of France, the losses suffered by Fairey Swordfish squadrons were relatively light when compared to other British aircraft, particularly those of the Royal Air Force. Admittedly, a lot of their missions were conducted against targets where the presence of German fighter aircraft was deemed to be very unlikely, but even so, many of these targets were still defended by numerous anti-aircraft weapons. And although many Swordfish returned home with battle damage, few were in fact lost. A lot of this was later attributed to its antiquated design of having an airframe that was covered in fabric. In essence, the Swordfish had a lot of empty space, which allowed bullets and small cannon shells to simply pass clean through, something that also benefited the partially fabric-clad Hawker Hurricane. This was particularly demonstrated when the Swordfish aircraft from 825 and 826 Naval Air Squadrons were deployed to assist in the evacuation of Dunkirk in Operation Dynamo. These aircraft flew from bases in the UK and provided cover for the retreating British forces. Their tasks included bombing raids on advancing German columns, supply dumps, and laying mines north of Dunkirk. All of these missions subjected the Swordfish to a hail of anti-aircraft fire, but so long as it didn't receive a direct hit to either the engine, the fuel tank, or the pilot, it simply carried on as if it hadn't been hit at all. Following the fall of France and the entry of Italy into the war on the 10th of June 1940, the strategic focus of the Royal Navy shifted to the Mediterranean, And this is where the Swordfish would put in some extensive service and earn much of its wartime fame. One of the first significant operations was conducted on the 14th of June 1940, when Swordfish from 767 Naval Air Squadron, stationed in southern France, carried out the first Allied bombing raid on Italian soil. Following this raid, the operational elements of 767 Squadron were redesignated as 830 Squadron, and they were relocated to Malta. Now, this might ring a bell for some people who are aware of the history of the fairy Swordfish, particularly in the Mediterranean, as 830 Squadron based in Malta would do a lot of work. It began with a series of raids against Italian naval and industrial targets. The first of these was a night raid on the 30th of June 1940, which targeted the oil tanks at Augusta in Sicily. This operation marked the start of a sustained effort to disrupt the logistics and supply chains of the Axis forces in the Mediterranean, and the Maltese Swordfish's biggest target soon became enemy shipping. Over the next 9 months, 830 Squadron, which never operated more than 27 Swordfish from Malta at any given point, would sink on average 50,000 tons of enemy shipping per month, and it would continue this mission for many months after this. By the end of the war, the Swordfish had sunk a greater tonnage of Axis shipping than any other Allied aircraft. To give an example of just how valuable the Swordfish was in this role, in normal operations, the collective airborne weight of 830 Squadron was approximately 940-ish tons. Now, in one record month, they sank just over 98,000 tons of shipping, which meant that each aircraft sank approximately 100 times its own weight in enemy supply and equipment. Now, aside from becoming the bane of logistics officers in Italian naval command, the Swordfish earned fame, and sometimes notoriety, in several other major events that took place in the Mediterranean theatre. One of the Swordfish's other early operations in the Mediterranean theatre was the controversial attack on Mers el Kebir, which began on the 3rd of July 1940. This operation aimed to neutralise the French fleet stationed in Oran in Algeria, to prevent it from falling into German hands after the armistice between France and Germany. On the evening of the 3rd, Swordfish from HMS Ark Royal were launched to attack the fleet, but none scored any direct hits. But 3 days later, they tried again, this time launching a concentrated attack against the French battleship Dunkirk. Now, despite some accounts claiming that the Swordfish did indeed cripple the French capital ship, they only did so indirectly. Even though Dunkirk was a stationary target, she proved remarkably difficult to hit. The shallow water of the harbour made torpedo dropping difficult, as the Swordfish had to fly very low and very slow, lest the weapon simply spear into the shallow seabed and be useless, and the approach to Dunkirk was blocked by several smaller vessels. The first wave in the Swordfish attack scored no hits at all, but one torpedo from the second wave hit a patrol boat which was moored alongside Dunkirk. Said patrol boat was loaded with 14 depth charges, and it was the collective detonation of these which is what actually crippled the battleship. Now, from a purely points-scoring perspective, Mers el Kebir was something of an anticlimax for the fairy Swordfish, as although it did damage several naval vessels, including a capital ship indirectly, it had not directly crippled or sank anything major by itself. However, it had proven that fleets could be vulnerable to enemy air attack in harbour, and this was further confirmed a few months later by an event that could be considered the Swordfish's crowning achievement, and that was the Battle of Taranto. Situated on Italy's southeastern coast, the port of Taranto was home to the bulk of the Regia Marina's battle fleet, including 6 battleships, 7 heavy cruisers, 2 light cruisers, and numerous destroyers and other support vessels. The base's location made it a critical hub for Italian naval operations in the Mediterranean, providing a stronghold from which the fleet could exert control over the surrounding seas and threaten British shipping routes. The concept of a surprise aerial attack on Taranto had actually been considered as early as the mid-1930s, and with the fall of France in 1940, the importance of such an operation became even more critical. Now, the Battle of Taranto is going to get its own in-depth video in the future, so I'm going to keep it relatively brief for now. But in short, the operation, codenamed Operation Judgment, went as follows. Before the raid, the British conducted several reconnaissance missions using Martin Marylands and Short Sunderlands to gather intelligence on the Italian fleet's positions and the harbour's defences. These missions were crucial in refining the attack plan, particularly in identifying the presence of anti-aircraft batteries and the extent of anti-torpedo netting around the ships, which was the biggest point. The torpedo nets were deep, but they did not reach all the way to the bottom of the harbour. By setting the torpedoes to run at a very specific depth, and by modifying the torpedo release system so that the weapon belly flopped into the sea rather than spearing down into the seabed, naval officers were confident that these defences could be overcome. The aircraft carrier HMS Illustrious, under Rear Admiral Lumney Leister, was chosen to carry out this attack, and she would be escorted by a powerful force of heavy cruisers, light cruisers, and destroyers. The key to the operation would be the use of the Fairy Swordfish, and the squadrons involved in the attack were 813, 815, 819, and 824 Naval Air Squadron, totaling 21 aircraft. Half of these aircraft would be equipped with torpedoes, while the others carried bombs and flares to create diversions and disrupt Italian defences. The attack on Taranto began on the evening of November the 11th, 1940, when the first wave of 12 aircraft, led by Lieutenant Commander Kenneth Williamson, took off from HMS Illustrious at 2100 hours. As the Swordfish approached Taranto, they encountered heavy anti-aircraft fire from both the ships and the shore batteries. Despite this, the first wave managed to launch their torpedoes and drop their bombs with remarkable accuracy. The battleship Conte di Cavour was hit by a torpedo that caused a significant breach in its hull, eventually leading to the ship sinking in the shallow waters of the harbour. Another battleship, Littorio, was struck by multiple torpedoes, causing severe damage that left it partially submerged. One torpedo was also launched at the flagship, Vittoria Veneto, but unfortunately it missed its mark. Along with these, the bomb-carrying Swordfish from the first wave attacked and successfully struck two cruisers and four destroyers. The second wave of nine Swordfish, led by Lieutenant Commander J.D. Hale, arrived approximately 90 minutes later to a slightly more awake and ready-for-defense Taranto, but nonetheless they still pulled off a successful attack as well. Five of them carried torpedoes, and one of these struck the battleship Giulio on her starboard side. The torpedo blasted a 11-by-7-meter hull in the hull, and the Italians had to scramble several smaller vessels to forcibly beach the battleship before she could sink. Another torpedo was once again also aimed at the flagship, Vittoria Veneto, but once again it missed and the Italian flagship was spared. Despite the heavy anti-aircraft fire, and despite having a top speed of less than 150 miles per hour, only two of the 21 Swordfish were lost during the attack, which could only be described as a resounding victory for the Royal Navy. In a single night, the British had inflicted severe damage on the Italian fleet, effectively neutralizing half of Italy's capital ship strength for several months. The success of the Taranto raid would also have far-reaching implications for naval warfare. It demonstrated the effectiveness of aircraft carriers and naval aviation in conducting offensive operations against enemy fleets, particularly when said fleet was in a supposedly safe harbour. Most importantly, it signalled the ascendance of naval strike aircraft over the big gun battleship as the most effective tool for destroying enemy naval assets. It's also been said that Taranto was the inspiration for the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in December 1941. However, the Japanese had already been working on shallow-running torpedoes since the late 1930s with this exact idea in mind, but Taranto certainly confirmed them in their line of thinking, and the Japanese carefully studied the attack, which helped them refine their own strategies for their attack in December of 41. Following Taranto, the Fleet Air Arm continued to operate the Swordfish in strikes against Axis shipping throughout late 1940 and into early 1941. On the night of the 11th of March 1941, six Swordfish from No. 815 Squadron, flying out of Paramythia in Greece, launched an attack on enemy shipping in the harbours of Durazzo and Valona in Italian-occupied Albania. Despite the challenges posed by both the shallow waters and the presence of enemy night fighters, the Swordfish managed to score two critical torpedo hits on enemy vessels. Then, a few weeks later, on March the 28th, the Swordfish played a role in the Battle of Cape Matapan, contributing to the sinking of three Italian cruisers. However, one of the most famous operations involving the Swordfish during 1941 was the pursuit and eventual sinking of the German battleship Bismarck. After the action in which Bismarck sunk the HMS Hood on May 24th, 1941, nine Swordfish from HMS Victorious would conduct the first aerial attack. The Swordfish located the German battleship using air-to-surface vessel radar, which allowed them to conduct their attack despite incredibly poor visibility. Unfortunately for them, in spite of this useful piece of equipment, only one torpedo would hit its mark during this sortie, causing only minor damage to Bismarck. Although the damage was not enough to significantly hinder Bismarck's operational capabilities, it did force the battleship to perform evasive manoeuvres that slowed her down, and this made it easier for the Royal Navy to continue its pursuit. The decisive moment involving Swordfish came on the 26th of May 1941, when Swordfish launched from Ark Royal carried out another attack on Bismarck. Earlier in the day, a first wave of Swordfish failed to locate her due to poor weather, but the second wave managed to find Bismarck in the late afternoon, despite the conditions worsening again. This attack proved to be the turning point in the pursuit. The Swordfish pilots, flying low and close to the waves to avoid Bismarck's anti-aircraft fire, launched their torpedoes at the German battleship. Two torpedoes struck her, with one hit being particularly crucial as it jammed the Bismarck's rudder, locking it in a 12-degree turn to port. This damage rendered the battleship unmaneuverable, effectively sealing her fate. Unable to steer, Bismarck was left circling in the Atlantic, vulnerable to the approaching British fleet, which closed in for the final engagement on May the 27th, at the end of which Bismarck sank from a combination of scuttling charges and extensive battle damage. Though the Swordfish aircraft from Ark Royal did not directly sink the Bismarck, their role in the operation could not be overstated. In a single moment, a tiny 3.5-ton aircraft had been able to successfully cripple a 50,000-ton battleship in the middle of an engagement. Like the attack at Taranto, the hunt for the Bismarck further reinforced the potential impact that carrier-borne strike aircraft could have in naval warfare. Now, taking a broader look at the career of the Swordfish outside these famous engagements, 1941 to early 1942 was a period that saw both highs and lows. It was a time that saw the Swordfish used to the fullest of its capabilities, sometimes with startling results as with Bismarck, but it also saw events that painfully highlighted its obsolescence. The experiences of Swordfish operated by the carrier HMS Hermes in particular serve as a good example of these shifting fortunes. In February 1941, they saw action against 16 Axis merchant ships that had been blockaded in the harbour at Mogadishu, in Italian Somaliland. When the ships attempted to break out of the harbour, they ignored British demands to return and continued on their journey. The Swordfish responded with a series of attacks, sinking at least three vessels and forcing two others to run aground. Later, in May of 1941, the same Swordfish squadron from HMS Hermes was also involved in quelling a pro-Axis rebellion in Iraq. The aircraft conducted bombing raids and close support operations against rebel-held barracks and forts until the insurgents surrendered later on in June. But following this campaign, HMS Hermes then sailed into the Indian Ocean, where her Swordfish were disembarked at Ceylon during a refit. Some of these aircraft were also stationed in Singapore when Japan launched their attack in December of 1941. Unfortunately, but also completely unsurprisingly, these Swordfish only survived for a few days under the intense Japanese assaults. The situation then became even worse in 1942 when six more Swordfish were airborne over Ceylon during a Japanese carrier-based airstrike against the port facilities. All six of these Swordfish were shot down by the Japanese, who suffered no losses in return, and in fact it was a complete aerial bloodbath. Both the Aichi D-3A dive bomber and the A6M-0 significantly outclassed the Swordfish in performance. In fact, the speed disparity between the Zero over the Swordfish was greater than the actual top speed of the Swordfish itself. It was clear that the poor performance of the Swordfish made it a sitting duck when facing off against even remotely contemporary fighter aircraft. And indeed, by the time that HMS Hermes was sunk by the Japanese in April of 1942, it was already being withdrawn as a frontline torpedo bomber. The last major attempt to use the Swordfish for torpedo attacks against enemy warships had actually occurred 2 months earlier in the cold waters of the English Channel. In February of 1942, one of the most daring and tragic events involving the Fairy Swordfish would take place during Operation Cerberus, also known as the Channel Dash. This operation involved the breakout of the German battleships Scharnhorst and Gneisenau, and the heavy cruiser Prinz Eugen from the port of Brest in occupied France. The goal was a daring run, using poor weather as a cloak, to get from this port back to Germany through the English Channel. Remarkably, the German ships avoided detection for more than 12 hours, and they weren't spotted by the British until they were basically in the Strait of Dover, by which point, belatedly, the Brits threw everything that they could at them. This included the Fairy Swordfish. Six Swordfish led by Lieutenant Commander Eugene Esmond from No. 825 Naval Air Squadron were involved in this event. Despite the obvious dangers posed by both the German ship's formidable anti-aircraft defences and the presence of Luftwaffe fighter escorts, Esmond and his squadron were prepared to launch their torpedoes in an attempt to halt the German warships. From the outset of this attack, their chances were slim. The weather was poor, with low visibility and heavy cloud cover, which not only made it difficult to locate the German ships, but it made it even harder to spot incoming enemy aircraft. As the Swordfish approached their targets, they were met by a fierce defensive screen. Approximately 15 Messerschmitt Bf 109 fighters, which had been escorting the ships, intercepted Esmond's formation. The outdated Swordfish, with their slow speed and minimal defensive armament, were no match in any way, shape, or form for the fast, modern, and cannon-armed German fighters. The result of the attack was tragic, but unsurprising. All six Swordfish were shot down by the German fighters before they could release their torpedoes. Of the 18 airmen who took part in the attack, only 5 survived. 13 were killed, including Lieutenant Commander Esmond himself. The bravery and determination displayed by the Swordfish crews did not go unnoticed. Esmond was posthumously awarded the Victoria Cross for his leadership and courage in the face of overwhelming odds. The other crew members' sacrifices were also recognised. Vice Admiral Bertram Ramsay described their attack as one of the finest exhibitions of self-sacrifice and devotion to duty the war had ever witnessed. Even German Vice Admiral Otto Tsiliaks, who commanded the German fleet during the Channel Dash, expressed his admiration for the courage displayed by the Swordfish crews, despite the hopelessness of their mission. The disaster of the Channel Dash was the last time that the Swordfish would be used for a large-scale torpedo attack against an enemy warship. But this did not mark the end of the type's wartime career. On the contrary, the most numerous iteration of the Fairy Swordfish had yet to even enter service. By late 1942, early 43, it was clear that the Swordfish was totally obsolete as a frontline torpedo aircraft, but in other roles it still had use. Based on reports from the early convoy patrols of 1939 and 1940, and with sorties assisting the Russian convoys in 1942, the Swordfish had the potential to be an excellent submarine hunter. Its ability to maintain stable flight at low speeds, and its good handling in poor weather, meant that it could stalk the German U-boats in the Atlantic with relative ease, so long as it had the right equipment to do the job. With this in mind, Blackburn and Fairey cooperated to increase both the performance and the firepower of the Swordfish, and this led to the Mark II variant. The first production Swordfish Mark IIs initially kept the same 690 horsepower Bristol Pegasus from the Mark I, but most of the Mark IIs were eventually fitted with the more powerful 750 horsepower Pegasus 30. They also received an enlarged oil cooler on the starboard side of the forward fuselage. But despite the beefier engine, the overall performance increase was minimal, and this was because of the added weight of the aircraft's strengthened airframe and the additional equipment that was installed. One of the key improvements of the Mark II was its firepower. Four rocket rails were mounted beneath each lower wing, and the wing structures were strengthened, with the undersides skinned with metal instead of fabric. The metal skinning was necessary as it protected the wings from the blast effect of the rockets as they were fired. Each underwing rack could carry four 3-inch 60-pound high explosive rockets, or four 3-inch 25-pound armor-piercing rockets. Developed by the Woolwich Arsenal in England, these rockets were first tested in October of 1941. They measured 4 feet long and used cordite as a propellant. This allowed them to reach a speed of 1,520 feet per second at a distance of 1,000 feet, and this increased to 1,700 feet per second after 3,000 feet. Swordfish pilots would launch these rockets in pairs, with one from each wing, or they could fire all eight in a single salvo. When launched together, the eight rockets fired delivered the equivalent firepower to the broadside of an average cruiser. However, the Swordfish would not have the luxury of engaging things at the same battle ranges as a cruiser. In fact, they had to get much, much, much closer. The ideal distance for launching these rockets at surfaced submarines was around 60 feet from the target. This gave the pilot little room for error and little time to pull away from any resulting explosion should the rockets manage to do catastrophic damage. The Swordfish Mark II enjoyed a very active career when it began to operate from escort carriers and merchant aircraft carriers in the anti-submarine role, a role in which its rockets proved to be highly effective. The first successful use of the new rockets occurred on May 13, 1943, when a Swordfish from 819 Squadron, flying from the escort carrier HMS Archer, attacked the German submarine U-752 in the North Atlantic. In this attack, the Swordfish made use of the armor-piercing rocket, which was often known simply as a spear, which made sense because it basically allowed the aircraft to spear the U-boat, much like a fisherman would spear a fish. The weapon pierced the submarine's pressurized hull and passed clean through to the other side, which, of course, prevented it from diving. Then, seeing Allied warships approaching, and with no hope to escape, the surviving crew of U-752 scuttled the U-boat and abandoned ship. Though the sinking of U-752 demonstrated the effectiveness of the rocket-armed Swordfish, more often than not, they barely saw the U-boats at all. Most Atlantic patrols by Swordfish saw little, and in most cases when a submarine was located, it was very rare that it was critically damaged or sunk without outside assistance. That did not mean that the Swordfish wasn't useful. It served as an excellent flying deterrent, and they did become even more effective when the Mark IIs began to be equipped with ASV radar. It was also around this time, as it was performing these escorting and anti-submarine missions, that the Swordfish finally got given its unofficial nickname of Stringbag. As the Navy started bolting bombs, rockets, radars, and sometimes even searchlights onto its old biplanes, somebody remarked that no housewife on a shopping spree could cram a wider variety of articles into her string bag, which was the name of a carrying bag that a lot of people used back then. The name caught on, and soon enough the aircrews aboard escort carriers and merchant aircraft carriers, or even those based at coastal air stations, whose job it was to patrol for enemy submarines, soon referred to their old-school warhorse as the string bag. This was further helped by the fact that it could also be used as an adequate description of the swordfish's appearance, and in later years it has been incorrectly stated that that is why the swordfish was called string bag, rather than the remarks about shopping bags. For the crews that operated the swordfish in this later role, their lot was often a thankless task, but it was still of vital importance to the Allied war effort, and the Mark II would become the most numerous swordfish variant to be produced, with 1,080 being built by Blackburn, before production shifted onto the penultimate version, the Mark III. It should also be noted that there was also a swordfish Mark IV. But this was not actually a new iteration of the type, but it instead represented about 100-ish Mark II aircraft which were converted for training use in Canada. Based at the Naval Air Gunnery School in Yarmouth in Nova Scotia, they were given an enclosed cockpit to protect their crews from the harsh climate of the Canadian winter. Why this modification wasn't retroactively made to other swordfish that were used on Arctic convoys, where the crews were quite literally hauled from the cockpits half frozen, is a mystery that has yet to be solved even today. But anyway, let's get back to the Mark III. Like the Mark II, this version was also intended for the anti-submarine role, but it carried the more advanced, and considerably heavier, Mark 11 ASV radar. This was mounted between the undercarriage legs in a streamlined housing, and it could detect surface vessels at a range of 60 kilometers. For detecting surfaced U-boats, it had an effective range of 20 kilometers, and in ideal conditions, and with a bit of praying to the machine spirit, it could also detect a U-boat at periscope depth, so long as the periscope was above the water, at a range of 8 kilometers. This radar greatly increased the effectiveness of the swordfish in the anti-submarine role, and it enabled it to effectively hunt even in the most challenging of weather conditions. Now, as the Mark III carried a heavier radar system, but was still powered by the same engine as the Mark II, its performance did suffer accordingly. Initially, this meant that the defensive gunner was dispensed with, but in 1944, the type began to make use of rocket-assisted takeoff. As hilarious as the idea might be of strapping a couple of rocket pods onto a flimsy biplane, it actually worked rather effectively, and it allowed the swordfish to either carry its third crew member again, or, as was more commonly done, it allowed for a larger fuel load to extend the aircraft's range on anti-submarine patrols. On these patrols, the Mark III and the Mark II were often operated together to form hunter-killer teams in nighttime operations against the U-boats, with some of the aircraft also carrying a large searchlight under the starboard wing. This proved to be an especially terrifying combination for the German submarine crews, as the advanced radar of the Mark III allowed the swordfish group to home in with remarkable precision in almost zero visibility, before blinding them with the searchlight and attacking them at near point-blank range with high-explosive or armor-piercing rockets. This was the role in which the swordfish would spend the rest of the war years, either operating from escort carriers or the merchant aircraft carriers. Many of these operated on the supply convoy route that ran from the United States to Gibraltar, but others also operated in the English Channel, the North Sea, and along the Arctic convoy routes that led to the Soviet Union. By war's end, the swordfish had flown thousands of sorties in the support of these convoys, and they were credited with the direct destruction of 12.5 submarines, the half being shared with another aircraft type on the same mission, along with assisting the sinking of 8 more in cooperation with escort ships. Despite its age, and despite the fact that it was more or less hopelessly obsolete by the beginning of the war, the Swordfish continued to prove its worth until the very end of the war. By 1945, 9 frontline squadrons were still equipped with the Swordfish. The last operational missions took place in the spring of 45, with anti-shipping operations off the coast of Norway, and these were conducted by 835 and 813 Squadron of the Fleet Air Arm. The last operational squadron was not disbanded until the 21st of May 1945, shortly after the end of war in Europe, and the final training squadron was still operational well into 1946. It was finally disbanded in the summer of that year, which officially marked the end of the Swordfish's active career. Production of the Fairey Swordfish had ended back in August of 1944, with the last aircraft delivered being a Mark III, which rolled off the Blackburn production line on the 18th. By that point, almost 2,400 Swordfish had been built, and the type had remained in service far longer than anyone had originally planned. Indeed, many Swordfish aircraft remained in active service for longer than the type designed to replace it, the Fairey Albacore. The Albacore was replaced by the Fairey Barracuda in the torpedo bombing role, and its own production was terminated a full year before the Fairey Swordfish. Ironically, the Swordfish owed its longevity to the same thing that often earned it criticism, its simple and dated design. By the time war broke out in 1939, the design of the Swordfish was well and truly obsolete, in an age where the skies were now filled with sleek or metal monoplanes. The Swordfish was an anachronism, but it was easy to build, it was easy to maintain, and performance-wise, it was more or less completely viceless. The simple and unspecialized design of the Swordfish meant that it was easily modified to suit a number of auxiliary roles, and in many use cases, its slow speed was actually considered an advantage rather than a detriment. Was it perfect? Absolutely not. Should it still have been a frontline torpedo bomber in 1939, 1940, 1941? Absolutely not. And it was only by a combination of careful mission planning and luck that more weren't lost in a giant bloodbath like what we saw with the Channel Dash. But despite the challenges, in spite of being technologically outclassed, the Fairey Swordfish and the brave air crews who flew it proved without a shadow of a doubt that obsolete did not always mean ineffective. Today, several surviving examples of the Swordfish can still be found, because it was A, very popular, and B, built in quite large numbers. Most of them are in museums. Several examples of the Mark II, Mark III, and Mark IV exist in a restored condition, and a sole airworthy example of a Mark I is operated by Navy Wings, based in Somerset in England. Now, if you want to learn a bit more about the history and the development of the Fairey Swordfish, I can recommend the following books. Naturally, we have from the Putnam Collection of Aeronautical Books, Fairey Aircraft Since 1915 by H.A. Taylor. Like anything from this collection, it is considered a must-have for aviation enthusiasts, though it is also the oldest book out of my recommendations, so the way that it's formatted and the text is a little bit dated, but it covers all the necessary information you would need. It covers the history of Fairey Aviation, its aircraft, and other ventures undertaken by the company. Next, we have a book titled Fairey Swordfish in Action by Squadron Signals. This book provides a really good general overview of the type's development history and its service history. Compared to other books, it doesn't go into as much mega-deep detail, but it serves as an excellent starting point. Now, if you do want to look into the history of the Swordfish in a bit more detail, I can recommend the following two books. First, we have Fairey Swordfish and Albacore by W.A. Harrison. Published in 2002, this is an excellent deep-dive read on the origins, the development, and the history of both types. 10 out of 10 can definitely recommend. And second, we have Fairey Swordfish by Matthew Willis, which is part of the Fleet Air Arm Legends series. This is the newest book published on the Swordfish, only published in 2022. It doesn't cover the technical information of the Swordfish in as much detail, but it provides a wonderful, wonderful and comprehensive account of the type's service history, and it includes some gorgeous illustrations. So, again, definitely a must-have. As always, thank you all so much for watching. And a big thank you, of course, to the Patreon supporters. I hope you enjoyed a return to the long, deep dive content. I'm going to be doing my best to make it a bit more regular, though it may mean a slightly slower upload schedule at times. But in my opinion, quality is better than quantity, at least as far as these videos are concerned. A big thank you, of course, to our Wing Commander tier patrons, our highest tier members. Recently, I attended the Pacific Air Show on the Gold Coast down here in Australia and took some amazing photos, so I will probably post a video about that soon. Also, feel free to check out my Instagram, as I'm going to be starting to post things on there regularly, like every couple of days a new photo will be going up. Now, some folks have also asked about buying prints, so I'm currently making inquiries with a few different companies to see what my options are, and hopefully I'll be able to launch a shop for my photos in the not-too-distant future. But that is all for today. As always, thank you all so much for your continued support. It means the absolute world to me, and I'll catch you all next time. Goodbye.